The College Game Day podcast is presented by Old Dominion Freight Line, helping the world keep promises.
We got a real simple plan. One man, one mission.
Georgia has won the national championship. Touchdown!
If you're a fan, you might think this is sports heaven.
This might be college football heaven.
This is ESPN's College Game Day podcast. Now alongside Pete Thamel is Reese Davis.
The new college football playoff rankings are out. Is the committee undervaluing teams in the Pac-12? One in particular, why Tennessee should be very happy with its position despite falling out of the top four. And looking ahead to Saturday and the return of the great Pete Thamel. This is the College Game Day podcast for Wednesday, November 9th. And first of all, Pete, for those of us joining us on YouTube, they can see that you're still in the winter hat, which we will discuss shortly. But first of all, how are the pipes? How are the sinuses? How are you feeling?
So I am back. I would probably be a game time decision on the injury report right now, but I'm good. Some sort of poltergeist got in my sinuses, and just travel 10 straight weeks. No one's complaining here because we love what we do, but just kind of drag me down. But I'm back and we're fighting hard. And I just did feel the comfort of a nice warm knit hat though this morning, if that's okay. I'm just lucky, Reese, that I got invited back because I listened to the podcast yesterday with just you and you actually didn't breathe the entire time. So it was pretty impressive. I mean, it was an hour straight of Reese talking without a breath, and it was all like perfectly woven together, themes, topics, different things. I was like, geez, I feel like I'm in the way of Reese from the pulpit. So, no, I appreciate you picking up the slack for me while I was out sick, partner. And it was a good listen. I enjoyed it last night. Whoever your sixth grade social studies teacher is really must have enjoyed the open to the college football playoff show last night, because you used every political jargon phrase. Like, I'm surprised you didn't get Tippy Canoe and Tyler too in there, because you pretty much hit them all with the election night theme running.
I wondered exactly who would pick that up, and in terms of not taking a breath, I had someone say to me once that they realized that I had been endowed with the gift of gab. And I said to them that I flatter myself that such is the case. In my line of work, it's plumb necessary, because the one thing you do not want is air in the conversation. $1 to the great John Goodman as Big Dan Teague for that line from O Brother, Where Art Thou? So there you go. So I did have fun with that open last night. My daughter has a friend whose brother is in the world of covering politics, and he saw it and he said, "Your dad must have been laughing when he read that script." And my daughter said, "Well, he wrote that script." He didn't. That's not the way it works at ESPN. So I did a little digging. I had the idea to do it. I mean, look, Digger Phelps used to do it a lot on election night. The great Silver Fox, who used to fancy himself as a future political candidate and had his slogan ready for running for president, "The nation needs a coach," but never quite made the leap over there, probably was happy with that open too. One more thing before we get to the rankings. You did a preemptive strike talking about your knit hat. Okay, first of all, what did you call it? You grew up in Boston, right?
Mm-hmm.
Okay, you call it a knit hat. Now, did you always call it a knit hat? What is the word that you used for your headpiece there?
So I would just call it a winter hat, but you could call it a stocking cap. You could call it a beanie. I do favor the beanie sometimes on the game day. When I started on game day, my first assignment was the draft show, and I showed up with a beanie a couple of times and it really threw people off. But I really just have bad hair. Not all of us were born with pocket squares in our pajamas and beautiful hair. So because of that, sometimes I dropped Teddy off at daycare this morning. I just needed something to cover my mane. Cut my ears from the winter chill in Boston. So
you've got good hair, and our makeup artist Trish has put some stuff together there for
you. She's earned a raise this year, I'll tell you that.
Do you know what? I don't know why. I wish I knew the etymology of this. In North Alabama, when it would occasionally get cold enough to need to put something on our heads, you know what we called that hat that you're wearing?
No, what?
A boggin.
Ooh, I've never heard that.
Yeah, like a boggin or a toboggan, which I know is more like, you know, a sled. But for whatever reason, and I don't know if that's still the jargon there, but when I was growing up, we called it a boggin.
B-O-G-I-N? Yeah.
No, like B-O-D, I don't know, really. I think B-O-G-G-A-N, but I don't know. Maybe I would think B-O-G-G-A-N, but I don't know.
I just asked the Google machine, and it says shop boggin and winter hat. A beanie boggin winter hat in the Marvel comics. Eight bun boggin ideas on Pinterest. Toboggan and boggin. Yeah, we'll have to let some fashionistas. I'll actually ask Kate. She used to buy coats in her job, so maybe there's some crossover. Her company is nationwide, so they probably have to know all the nuances of what things are called in different places. So we'll get back. But the winter hat is only going to show up more during the winter. I can assure you for that.
Well, and I think as we look ahead to where College Game Day might wind up, it's going to be a little chilly in Austin.
Yes.
I think Saturday night. One would assume that we will be in Columbus, where it will be frigid and gray when they play Michigan, and then in between
Big Ten weather.
Yeah, it remains to be seen where we wind up. Rankings came out last night. New number one, Georgia at the top, as they should be after that impressive beatdown of Tennessee. I still had Tennessee hanging in at four, but I have no problem with TCU being ranked four and ranked ahead of them. Anything jump out at you about the rankings from last night?
Yeah, I think the first thing was that good on the committee for just having some flexibility, right? And seeing TCU get a big win and kind of putting them in that four spot. And I think a little bit acknowledging that they might have had them too low in the first place. And what I do like about this and generally believe about the College Football Playoff and its committee is that it is a week to week ranking, and they do rearrange it based on, you know, they Yahtzee it every week and come back with a new one. So I just don't like being like clinging to old principles. I think this could be the best CFP race, Reese, we've had since that initial year that TCU and Baylor got snubbed, and Cardale, you could use Cardale as a verb there. Ohio State Cardaled their way in with the blowout of Wisconsin in the College Football Playoff, which, by the way, I picked Wisconsin in that game, which I think our faithful listeners would know that would go in line with my picks this year. But I do think that's been the most controversial one we've had, and it's because there were just different, you know, there were a handful of different schools that could make an argument for that four spot. And I think you forecasted on the show, like we are going to likely face our first repeat, like the committee is going to have to face whether or not they want a rematch. And, you know, there seems pretty good odds statistically, if Georgia holds that one, that someone in that four spot, they could end up playing twice. So, yeah. And you brought up the two Big Ten team point, which obviously becomes very real. And I do think a discussion is going to be echoed throughout the couple of weeks of Michigan canceling that UCLA game. And, you know, the intent of schedule, like, can you reward them and punish Oregon? I think somebody made the point last night on the show of like Oregon could have played Portland State and they'd be sitting in a much different position right now. So I think there's almost all these. I'm really excited to see how the race unfolds, because there are all these hot topics that we've kind of seen over the years all sort of barreling down at once. And a lot of them are new and fresh. And I like that there's, you know, when you go 4, 5, 6, you've got three teams that, Oregon did make it in the first year and they made the title game, obviously. But you've got basically teams that haven't, you know, new blood that hasn't been there in the last 8 years. So that's exciting to me. And again, we don't have biases. We're fans of the sport. And I think we're fans of the sport from, you know, Boston to San Diego and Miami to Seattle. And we like to see it stretched out and, you know, every region kind of be recognized. So I think it's a, I think it's one of the more exciting races that we've had.
It's hard to discuss the rankings without someone nitpicking, you know, especially on social media or whatever, something, you know, that has been said, or, you know, saying that you hate this team, hate that team for this reason or that reason. There are a couple of takeaways that I had from looking at the rankings, and all of this, we should offer the disclaimer at the beginning. If everybody starts losing inexplicable games, then you throw it all up and you start over. But if things sort of hold form without a ridiculous number of upsets, I feel like Tennessee has LSU blocked out because of the way they won that game, winning it by 27 points. Because even if LSU beats Georgia in the SEC championship game, certainly you'd listen to arguments for LSU and understand that one of the losses was by 1 point on the opening night and all of that. But you can't, or I couldn't. I should say it this way. If I were in that committee room, there is no way I could rank LSU ahead of Tennessee based on what they did. Now, head-to-head's not the be-all, end-all, especially if it's a close, tight game and a lot of time has passed. But when the victory is that emphatic and it's on your home field, which, by the way, that's another little check mark in Tennessee's favor when they start being evaluated for a spot, likely the fourth spot, maybe the third one, is that start going down the list of contenders and find me a great road win. That's about it. Ohio State has a good one. A good road win at Penn State. I wouldn't say that it's a great one. And maybe one could argue that, you know, the difference in a two-point conversion against Alabama is what makes LSU, the win over LSU, a great one as opposed to a good one. And that's a fair argument as well. Hard to find a great road win. Tennessee has one. And I still, while I'm starting to see the avenue for what you've dubbed the Reese Davis principle of getting blown out, you can't make it into a four-team field. I see the avenue for Oregon, but were I in that committee room, that would still be a major problem for me to get past. It would be a difference maker. You know, Kirk brings up, and rightfully so, a lot of times about when teams are in a cluster, that they are very similar in a lot of aspects, that you start to find differentiating factors, whether it be conference championships, head-to-head. If a team is unequivocally better than another one, then those factors tend not to come into play. I think they're really going to come into play this year because a lot of these teams are really clustered, and that, in my judgment and evaluation of these teams, is a really big deal. And I irked some Tennessee fans last night, but I believe this to be true from watching both games. The score didn't get out of hand the way the Georgia-Oregon game did. But that game was every bit the beatdown in terms of after the first or second series, there was no doubt in my mind who was going to win the game. And, you know, I don't mean that as a slight to Tennessee. I think they're a worthy playoff team. And would it be different on a neutral field? Maybe. You know, that was the most... I've been to Sanford Stadium a number of times over the years. Never been like that. Never been that intimidating.
Electric.
Yeah.
Electric.
And so... you know, those are things I think that are going to, just as you said rightly, it's going to make this playoff race maybe different from any of the other ones we've seen. Maybe it's most similar to 2014.
Yeah. So I do feel like I need to address, I've gotten quite a few angry emails and Twitter messages from Georgia fans about the anonymous coach survey, where one coach did say that he thought there was, you know, a few coaches thought Tennessee had a path to victory and one thought they could score 50. Mm-hmm. That coach was obviously wrong. And, you know, people felt like I needed to like get up in front of the, get up in front of the dunk tank to do that. No, but I do think, I do think it's interesting, right? Because I've done these stories a lot over the years and, you know, you do write sort of the things that people say that are different and, you know, mm-hmm. observations that are different. And, you know, so why did Tennessee not score 50? Well, I saw three pre-snap penalties and I have to admit I left at halftime because I just thought Tennessee had no chance to win. And
they
so
didn't.
I wanted to get to the airport. And so there was probably more than three. So Tennessee's operation was poor on the road. Like they were not ready for the moment in a lot of ways. You know, Reese, you spoke about this on the podcast on Monday. Jalen Carter
was in full force, a monster, an unstoppable, maybe the best player in college football, like some scouts had said. And I can't say with any authority, he was good in the Florida game, but he had not been that kind of player this year. Now, he'd obviously missed some games with injury. They'd been careful with him. So when some of these coaches evaluated Georgia, it was with either a limited or a missing version of Jalen Carter. He's obviously the, massive defensive tackle who NFL scouts really like because he's so dynamic for his size, that he has elite pass rush ability, which you just don't see on the interior of the defensive line. And Reese, you and I stood there on the sideline and watched him swallow Tennessee linemen whole. I mean, there's no other way to say it. He swallowed them whole, especially on the play that should have been a safety, and I still don't understand why it wasn't. I mean, he just absolutely, he was like Pac-Man, just going through on that. So that caliber player playing at that level makes them a lot different. And I think people misjudged both Georgia's depth, which really came into play, I thought, the depth of talent, being able to rotate different guys in, stay fresh, and stay consistent in their scheme and not have significant drop-off. And look, the corners played elite. Like, there's no other way to say it. The awesome. Weakness people kept pointing to in Georgia were the different corners, be it Lassiter, be it Bullard. And those guys did not get picked on. They did not get exposed. They did not get exploited. And they did not get run behind. And I just thought, like, we watched Georgia's guys run free behind the Tennessee secondary. I mean, just run free. And that's what we've seen Tennessee do all year, including to Alabama, which was jarring to see in person. And that just didn't happen. So credit to Kirby Smart, credit to a great plan, and credit to a Georgia secondary that answered the bell.
And talking about Jalen Carter seems like a great time to bring up Best in Game, brought to you by Old Dominion Freight Line, helping the world keep promises.
The 2024 NFL Draft heads to Detroit, and it's time to see who gets the job.
Caleb is a unique and special talent throwing the football.
And what sets them apart.
The Heisman Trophy winner is Jaden Daniels.
All of the greats were hired here.
What a throw by Mahomes.
See who gets the job.
Are you ready?
The 2024 NFL Draft begins Thursday, April 25th on ESPN, ABC, and NFL Network.
As we turn the page and look ahead to this week, Georgia has shown that when interested, that they're dynamic and brutal to deal with. Do you anticipate Georgia being as interested in Starkville Saturday night? Now, there's no reason in the world to expect that Mississippi State is going to be able to do much more than it did against Alabama. I know there are differences structurally in the defense, and Kirby Smart's changed some things, but they both have a pretty good handle on how to slow down that offense, and State's not at that level. But we've seen Georgia be disinterested a couple of times this year, and they were so locked in Saturday afternoon for the Tennessee game that one wonders if maybe they could get caught hitting the snooze button, at least for a little while, and make that game a little more interesting than it has any right to be.
Yeah, it's funny because Leach's teams are always this way and Mississippi State's this way. Like, that Auburn game, to me, was the perfect encapsulation of a Leach team. They go storm out to, I believe, a 24-7 lead at halftime, and then the other team comes and storms back. Like, the offense is scorching hot, and then it goes ice cold. And so it's always tricky to project who shows up. But look, it's another test for that secondary. If that secondary isn't dialed in, they can start moving the ball a little bit on you. It's another test for that defensive line, which clearly got elite push. Can they do that again against a Mississippi State offensive line that's been fairly competent this season? I don't think it's dominant by any means. I don't think they'll get caught napping, because I do think sometimes when a team plays that way, it starts to realize and sense its potential and can keep going. And we may see that with Georgia. But what I do like, Reese, about just as we cast over the rest of the season, a Georgia-Ohio State matchup would excite me. I think a Georgia-Michigan matchup would be closer than it was last year in the playoff. I don't think anybody's giddy about seeing that game again, potentially in the same stadium, right? Would it be in the same stadium?
It's Fiesta and Peach this Peach. Year.
Okay.
So it'd be a different stadium.
It would be Oregon would be the same stadium. I'm messing up in my mind. But I do think Michigan is better equipped with more dynamism at quarterback, and Georgia's defense still is not the historically good, 15 players overall drafted. And what did they have? 8 starters drafted on the defense last year. It's just not quite there. So I think Michigan's a little better. I think, Georgia's has a slight dip, and I think that game is a little bit closer. So I do think there's some very intriguing drama left, as you roll out the rest of the field here.
I think now that the calendar has turned to November, that we are less likely to see a disinterested Georgia as well. And it could well be that it wouldn't take very long before the Mississippi State players are wishing perhaps that they could find a shade tree and a fish sandwich and some lemonade and sit around with their significant others. That was another all-time Leach rant in the post game too, which, hey, he's a gift that keeps on giving, whether it annoys you or doesn't. I mean, it's so hilarious and bizarre. And he even said he was working on trademarking his cough.
How about him wanting to clear out the athletic department when John Cohen left? Did you see those?
I did not.
He was like, he said something about Cohen. He's like, yeah, they could use to clean out a few other people out of there too.
never changed. Let's talk a little bit about TCU in Texas.
Sure.
And let me clarify something I sort of said offhandedly, because I wanted the message out there. I said that the reason game day is going to Austin, certainly we love Austin, but it's to follow the TCU story. And that's true. But the reason we're following the TCU story to Austin is because they're in danger in Austin of being knocked from the ranks of the unbeaten. And the other interesting aspect of it is that Big 12 race is so competitive, and there, and because of what's in front of both teams, there's a really good possibility that no matter how the game turns out, that we could see it again in the Big 12 championship game. Because even if Texas loses, they still play Baylor. They only lose the head-to-head tiebreaker anyway to Oklahoma State. And the way Oklahoma State looks right now, well, I don't think they're done losing. It certainly doesn't look that way at the moment.
They've fallen off a cliff.
Yeah, they really have. So the reason we're going there is to follow the TCU story. But it's because the TCU story is going to be challenged to such a degree that the early line, at least, has Texas as a touchdown favorite over the undefeated number 4 team in the country. So, I mean, that's a huge story,
our friend Coach Corso would say.
So do you think the people who know something are correct?
I mean, it would not surprise me at all if TCU lost. It's obvious with the spread where it is. It's hard to say with any conviction that Texas is just going to roll over, because they have the best tailback in the country. They have one of the 10 best receivers in the country, and they have a quarterback whose talent is as top 5 in the country. So when you have those things, now look, they have issues at right tackle, they have issues on the offensive line, their defense has been temperamental at best. They have fourth quarteritis and have had it for multiple years. But I do think, boy, like, if they stay disciplined in running Bijan Robinson, they could probably, they could roll and win this game. They could roll and win this game. I don't think Texas is capable of dominating TCU.
I don't either. Yeah.
But if they, if they won 35-28, I would, that would not be a stunning result to me. But that was one of those lines that put a smile on my face, because I was like, I can totally see that. If you had asked me, Sunday night, what I thought the line would be on that game, I probably would have said Texas favored by a field goal. Mm-hmm. So I'll be curious on our Friday pod, Reese, what Bill Connolly's numbers say. Now, that remember, the numbers love Texas.
Yeah.
Like, the numbers are as infatuated with Texas as preseason voters are with Texas, right? So Bill has joked a few times with us that he's almost had to like offer apologies for how much the numbers do like the Longhorns. So it's a it's an interesting moment in time for both programs, because for how much Texas has squandered this year, there's still quite a bit in front of them, and they could go and do what hasn't been done there in quite a long time and win the Big 12. Was their last Big 12 title Colt McCoy, or did they win one after that?
No, they lost in the Big 12 championship game, I know, with Ellinger after they'd beaten Oklahoma in the regular season. They had the rematch and they lost. So I should know that off the top of my head, Pete. I think it is, unless I'm skipping one, but I can't.
I'm just happy that I stumped you. That's pretty, I've learned that's pretty hard to do.
Big 12 champions by years, according to Wikipedia, my favorite fake news source. 2009 Texas. So since Texas has last won the Big 12, Oklahoma's won it. Oklahoma State has won it. Baylor has won it. Has TCU won it? TCU and Baylor split it. So TCU did win it in 14. So that's a lot of schools not hooking them who've won the Big 12 in that time. And for Sark, who's trying to establish a foothold for the SEC too, because you always remember the big pictures in mind, not having Oklahoma as a foil. When you look at Oklahoma, which
they won the Big 12 like every year. That means
they won it 15-20.
Yeah.
So until Aranda upset the apple cart last year. So, and Bob Stoops, like Mack Brown won like almost hilariously few Big 12 titles. When you go back and look at the,
Him, I'll bet.
But. Nope. Not funny to him at all. But like, it just, considering how great his run was there.
Yeah.
He was a distinct second fiddle to Bob Stoops. So, anyway, it's, but thank God they figured out that I was a Texas thing and made Sark apologize, right?
Texas is dangerously close to being in this mix. And I looked up because it's a quick little click as opposed to looking at Bill's SP Plus. I took a quick peek at FPI to see the difference. And there's about a Texas is number six in the FPI, but if you look at the actual number, there's about a 6-point edge that FPI gives Texas over the average top 25 team, as opposed to what it would give TCU, which that combined with home field probably accounts, because all of those power rating systems, I don't understand the algorithms and the formulas the way Bill does, or you know, the people who formulate them, the great Dean Oliver, who was with us at ESPN, is now in the NBA, when they formulate all of those. But they've schooled me up and taught me about how to look at it to determine that. So that's probably where you get the touchdown difference. And there are flaws in any formula, but Texas easily could have won the Alabama game. They blew the double digit leads. They could be sitting there 8-1 or 9-0. And so certainly they're very capable. But once again, pivotal game for them to determine what kind of season they have. Now, I mentioned they could still make it if things fall right for them to the Big 12 championship game, but it's still a four loss season if they lose Saturday night. So, you'd be able to rub some salve on that wound if you ended up getting a rematch and winning the Big 12 championship, but it would still be a four loss season, which is not what you're after at Texas. So pretty pivotal game for them. And I also think, and you know, I asked Sonny this question last night, and it's one that will be asked of Boo Corrigan going forward. Should TCU stumble either Saturday night or at Baylor in the Big 12 championship game? I think the Big 12, and I'll never give him that off ramp again, by the way, by failing to mention, I will say that your schedule, if you play in the Big 12 with 9 conference games, has been formidable enough that a single loss shouldn't eliminate you from consideration. Now, should it mean you automatically go if you win the Big 12? No. Yeah. But I don't think that TCU should be evaluated solely because they have the zero in the loss column. If they lose by a field goal Saturday night, come back, beat Baylor, beat Texas in a rematch, they're very worthy of being considered of getting into the playoff. This is not a weak schedule that they played. that would demand that they go undefeated, like say Cincinnati was last year.
Yeah. Let me ask this, Reese, and I started making some calls on this yesterday. I'll have more on this on game day on Saturday. The TCU-Oregon comp is interesting, right, to me. Fairly similar teams in some ways. There's some flaws. There's some things to like. There's some knocks. Oregon, obviously, their resumes aren't similar in that Oregon obviously has that horrific early loss but has really recovered and played well. TCU's, you know, fighting some stigmas over their style. If Oregon and TCU played on a neutral field in Greenwood, Indiana tomorrow, who would you favor? Pretty good question, right?
I think, in all honesty, Pete, I would probably give a slight edge to Oregon. I think their defense is a little bit better. That's basically, even I'm looking at the FPI numbers, that's like a 2-point difference. That's a toss up. I'd probably lean Oregon slightly on a slightly better defense. And, you know, I'm not totally convinced of that, but that'd be where I'd lean right now. How about you?
Yeah, I would probably say Ducks by a field goal. But I do think, like, you know, if those teams played 10 times, you know, one would win 6 and one would win 4 or something like that. Like, it's, I think those teams are fairly equal in some ways. I think, you know, both have pretty good offensive lines. You know, TCU has much better offensive skill on the outside. You know, Oregon's got a little more pop maybe on their defensive ends. You know, different quarterbacks, right? One has really evolved, and both have really evolved and played well, right? I mean, Max Duggan didn't start this year. You forget against Colorado, and then came in the second half, and they just, you know, absolutely just started this blitzkrieg of a season from that point on. So, yeah, I think two really
interesting teams. One stat that I found interesting is that I think Oregon has only given up like one sack this year. It's something pretty remarkable. You know, they've literally given up one sack this year. So I think that just speaks to the soundness of the operation, right? If you have a line, that means you have a great offensive line, you have a great scheme that's making sure the quarterback is protected. That means you have a veteran quarterback who's making line calls and adjustments to be sure, you know, free guys are getting picked up and he's not getting. I just think that is a high compliment to just the soundness of where their offense is, that there is only one sack. And that, in a lot of ways, that's going to keep you in a lot of games, you know, moving forward. So I thought that was just a really interesting window into the Ducks.
Totally agree. And if the Ducks defense is a difference maker in the big picture, as you start evaluating them against other teams, it might well be tested Saturday night by Washington, who very quietly brings in the nation's leading passer and Michael Penix Jr. and some dangerous receivers. And, you know, a team that's had a really good season also under a first-year coach in Kalen DeBoer. They would love nothing better than to spoil the season. Historically, Washington has looked down its nose at Oregon, you know, sort of perceiving itself to be of a higher level bastion of academia than the Ducks. And then in recent years, with Oregon's success and the Nike money from Phil Knight and the flashy uniforms and the trips to the playoff, although Washington has one trip to the playoff, you know, all of those things have sort of tilted the more recent scales of attention. But that rivalry is still intense and bitter and dates back to Washington aligning against Oregon to keep them out of the Rose Bowl in the 40s, you know, in a vote. You know, they aligned and allegedly lobbied Montana to vote with them so that California would go to the Rose Bowl rather than Oregon. And so that was for the 48 season, 49. So there, the old timers are still bugged by that. There's the great Kenny Wheaton pick six that they just simply called the pick that sort of turned the fortunes of Oregon football in the 90s when Washington was a powerhouse and they were going in to win in Autzen Stadium. They still play it on the video board. you know, before the game there. So this is a deep-seated rivalry that's important to both. And if Washington could come in and turn that thing upside down, there would be plenty of delight in Seattle over that turn of events for sure.
Yeah, a lot of respect for what Kalen DeBoer has done, giving an adrenaline shot to that Huskies program. It's just good to have Washington back vibrant. I think it's really important for the future of that league for Washington to really be a tentpole. They can't afford to lag. I'm really excited, Reese, to see Oregon defensive back Christian Gonzalez, who some NFL people think maybe first, second defensive back off the board. Keely Ringo sure played better than my anonymous coach just thought he would against Tennessee the other night. So he's probably going to be the first one off the board. But Christian Gonzalez is a Colorado transfer. He's from the Colony in Texas. He's 6'2", 201. We saw him on, you know, up close on the field in Eugene. He's a big, long, lanky kid who looks like they look like on Sundays. So, and we know Penix is going to obviously be throwing the ball. Kalen DeBoer's offense is always due. So it'd be a lot of fun to see if he can be the menace that, you know, that he's been billed as, and he's played really well for the Ducks this year. So I'm really excited to see that little nuance of that matchup this weekend.
Yeah. Transfer quarterbacks again, both of whom have flourished in their new settings, coming basically across the country. Bo, and it's been documented, Bo Nix coming from Auburn. Michael Penix Jr., after enduring just a slew of injuries during his time at Indiana, back with Kalen DeBoer, who at one time was the offensive coordinator at Indiana. Though I think people sometimes forget the big season that Penix had, I think, was in the COVID year. DeBoer was already gone, but he had started his career under him, and that reunion has paid great dividends there. LSU was a topic too in the college football playoff rankings last night, going to number 7, potential 2-loss SEC champion. Could they get in if they were to keep winning and knock off Georgia? I would really be worried about LSU noon game in Fayetteville, coming off that euphoric victory against Alabama, if I hadn't watched Arkansas and Liberty. Now, Hugh Freeze has a good team and has done a marvelous job with Liberty. But Arkansas, I mean, they tried to rally late, but they looked out of sorts and ungood, as I like to say, against the Flames on Saturday. And because of that, I mean, it's, you know, Lou Holtz taught me years ago, it's a different team every week. You never get the same team. But if you get anything approximating the same teams that we saw last week, then it's hard to fathom LSU going in there and losing to what I saw from Arkansas on Saturday. That was a little shocking to me. It wasn't shocking to Herbstreit. Took him as a super dog, which was a great call for Liberty. But, you know, Arkansas, they didn't just lose. They were down big. Now, they almost pulled it out and got the thing in overtime, but man, they were down big and sort of getting dominated for a lot of the game.
As our listeners will know, my knack for leaving very important moments. Remember, we're in Boone, where the game ended with probably the best single ending of a college football game this year,
most dramatic anyway. LSU Alabama is probably going to take the best ending, but there was obviously the Hail Mary. I was long out of App State by the time the Hail Mary went, because I went to watch Liberty play at Wake Forest. And if you had asked me my 10 impressions of Liberty from that game, and I was impressed, we talked about it on the podcast, they had a dynamic quarterback who transferred from Tennessee. They had some great skill. They had some, you know, some. I would not, none of my 10 observations would have been, they're going to maul you up front. You know, Wake Forest did at times struggle to block them. So I'm not going to be naive to that. And they did have enough of a rush against that slow mesh to really like cut off the run game, and they forced Wake Forest to throw. But I didn't walk out of that stadium thinking that's someone who's going to manhandle an SEC team, right? I thought they had good personnel. I was impressed. You know, the game essentially came down to a 2-point conversion that Liberty didn't convert. So I was pretty surprised. But you know, credit Josh Aldridge, the defensive coordinator at Liberty. He's in his first year there as the DC and play caller. They've put together something special on that side of the ball. Like, I don't care which SEC team it is. If you go on the road, you're an independent like Liberty, and you can just ragdoll an SEC team on their turf, that's pretty impressive. You know, I do think it will be a really interesting test for LSU in terms of like handling success, right? Mm-hmm. Because they, you know, they lost early and everybody got their spine straight. They've gotten Kayshon Boutte sort of back seemingly right. Now, he's not the explosive, productive, surefire first round pick he was, but he is again like a high functioning part of that offense. Jaden Daniels' early struggles have really fed into some significant development. His footwork's a lot cleaner. His decision making's a lot better. You know, his running ability is still dynamic, but there's a diversity to his game now in terms of the throw and multiple reads that wasn't there early. So there have been a lot of things that have pushed forward against LSU. Young talent like Harold Perkins, the linebacker, I thought he flashed on my TV screen on Saturday night. Terrific. I mean, my gosh, what a difference maker he was. You know, right in that lexicon of LSU defensive creatures that we've become accustomed to over the years. So LSU clearly has the talent. It's a hard place to play. An 11 a.m. kick. Like, don't be surprised if that game's 7-3 at the end of the first quarter, you know, at the end of going into halftime, something like that. Pittman's going to have them charged up. That fan base, you know, this is a game that's circled for them every mm-hmm. year. Mm-hmm. And you're at the point where it's like you can salvage the season if you're Arkansas. If you win this game, because all of a sudden, if you don't, you're scrambling to make a bowl because you've got Ole Miss at home next, which you're going to be an underdog in, and then you go to Missouri the Friday of Thanksgiving weekend, and both those teams could be 5-6 in a in a dogfight for a bowl game.
That is the one thing. I mean, it looks like that would be an easy pick, but Pittman is going to challenge them because of what happened against Liberty. This is sort of another one of those, maybe not last stand games for Arkansas, but it's really their last chance to make a huge impression on the season. Playing Ole Miss, they could have another chance, because Ole Miss is certainly rooting for Arkansas to beat LSU, because while LSU, you know, beat the doors off of Ole Miss, the Rebels, if they beat Alabama, could in theory still get back on top and have a game edge on LSU if Arkansas could pull the upset and Ole Miss can beat Alabama on Saturday. So, you know, there's some stuff to play for in Arkansas. While it won't factor in actually winning the division itself, Arkansas could salvage the season by having a huge say in who does. Maybe from Sam Pittman's point of view, maybe you take it away from LSU for a moment and give it to Ole Miss, and then take it away from Ole Miss and give it right back to LSU the following week, you know?
They have brought the, as his old saying from earlier this year, they have brought the tea and not the liquor. If they bring the liquor the next 2 weeks, they can really shake up the SEC West. Really shake it up. Not stirred, shaken.
Yeah, they brought weak, watery green tea on a Saturday. But, you know, I shouldn't say that, because that takes away from Liberty, and I really shouldn't. Let me ask you this. Game like that, the way Hugh Freeze had them ready, the way he has consistently won there, and the fact you know that he's had success in the SEC, and I know that there were issues and you know, the SEC, you know, wanted to, as a conference, sort of wanted to make him wait a little bit because of the things that had gone on at Ole Miss under his watch there as it pertains to rules violations and so forth, or alleged rules violations. What does a game like that last Saturday do for his candidacy for bigger jobs? I think most of us believe that Lane Kiffin is the number one target for Auburn, unless you have other information about that. But Hugh Freeze certainly on the list. What does that do for him, in your judgment, from what you've been able to ascertain from potential suitors? And look, Liberty fans, if you're listening, I know he signed a contract extension. Yeah, and we know how that works too. So what does it do for him as a potential candidate?
I don't know if I would say Lane is like the runaway favorite. I would think there are three sort of, you know, there's a grouping of three that I think the job will emerge from. And I think that those three are Rule, Kiffin, and Freeze. Drastically different candidates, by the way, in so many different ways. They're different styles, different personalities, just a lot of different in that group. So
But I think for Freeze, it's a reminder that he's had a lot of success in big games. He doesn't flinch on the big stage. He is as good of a play caller as there is in the country. Now, the baggage is the baggage. You know, there's no getting around that. I think the NCAA portion of that baggage is probably less because essentially NCAA rules enforcement / IARP, which is really recent in this, they just seem to be so toothless. And really, more importantly, like our friend Doug Girard, the Kansas chancellor, presidents and chancellors don't care if coaches break rules anymore. I mean, Kansas was in the thicket of an NCAA investigation and they gave Bill Self a lifetime contract. And I use that as a way to say, you know, the NCAA baggage used to carry a lot more weight than it once did. So
and then the personal failings thing, which, you know, I hesitate to bring up, but that would seem to be old news by now too. And he's sort of seemed to have turned that around and healed from that, right?
You know, when it comes to personal stuff, I don't tend to make judgments one way or another.
Like, right, I agree. I'm talking about as it pertains to him.
Yes,
being hired. That's all I mean.
Yes,
in terms of being hired.
Yes. Yeah. I'm not a pearl clutcher. I'm not in personal judgments. The worst part of that was he did it on a school phone.
Yeah.
Like that was right. Just stupid. Like that just, you know, do what you want to do. I'm not going to judge you. But like that, the fact that you would expose yourself risk-wise to that on your school phone, that always just baffled. That always boggled my mind a little bit. But yeah, he has gone to Liberty, you know, been there a bunch of years, you know, and performed the way you would think he would perform the way he did at Arkansas State, performed the way he did at Ole Miss. It's dynamic offenses. It's talented players. You know, Liberty's not the easiest place to recruit to, and he's sort of figured out ways to get really talented players. Their skill guys were great that day against Wake. You know, Clawson told me after the game that he said to his team that week, like, we may not see better skill guys on the outside all season, or maybe UNC, like, they're in the conversation with the top of the ACC with that. So he was always figured out a way to do it. And it would be, you know, it's going to be fascinating theater at Auburn, no matter what. Auburn is always fascinating theater. Kiffin would be unbelievable. I made a joke in the column the other day that the servers were our friends at AL.com would actually, they'd have to like reinforce them for all the content Lane would give them, needling Saban and being his foil. And I say that endearingly. Those guys do a great job covering that, you know, both ends of that rivalry. And that would be, you know, I mean, I like to joke, I call it the Feinbaum principle, that no matter what happens, it creates great content for Paul Feinbaum, right?
Mm-hmm.
And Lane Kiffin, you know, at Auburn with Nick Saban would be unbelievable. I mean, Freeze's return would certainly be, you know, pretty dynamic. If Matt Rhule went there, you know, a complete outsider with no ties to the Deep South comes in and, you know, tries to do what he did at Temple and Baylor and, you know, bring the thing back and build it up to where, you know, to where it's competitive in the league again, like he did so well at those other places. So he'd obviously be an energy bolt and a complete, you know, he grew up in, you know, Manhattan, basically Roosevelt Island. So it's, you know, and then went to State College High School, I believe. So it just, it would be all those candidates would be fascinating. There's plenty of other fascinating ones too, but it would certainly, there's never lack of fodder down there in your home state, Alabama, Reese.
There's not, you know, you say you have that Matt Rhule has no ties to the South. I would say that there is one tie that he does have. He developed an affinity for the late Coach Pat Dye's weekly radio segment on the sports talk radio station in Birmingham. And he would often listen to Pat Dye when he was going in because you knew Pat, I know. And he got to a point, not that he ever really cared that much what people thought about what he said, but he got to a point later on where he'd just go. And Matt would pick that up somehow in satellite radio and he would listen to that from time to time. So he wouldn't be totally
really I've never heard that.
He had a sports information director at Baylor who was from the state of Alabama. I think maybe grew up a
Taylor
Auburn
Bryan,
fan.
Right?
Yeah, Taylor. And I think he went to Troy, but maybe grew up an Auburn fan. And somehow they've made that connection. And Matt got a kick out of that for a period of time during his Baylor career. So that might be the lone tie. And I would advise, should that come to be, that John Cohen hires Matt Rhule to be the head coach at Auburn. If I were Rhule, one of the first things I would talk about would be that, you know, when I step to the podium. Sure. Let me throw something at you.
Yeah.
There was a bolt of energy that Cadillac Williams brought to Auburn. He is very new in his coaching career overall, let alone being a head coach. But let's say last Saturday of the regular season before Championship Saturday, that they somehow, some way, go into Bryant-Denny Stadium and beat Alabama with Cadillac Williams as a head coach. Then what?
You go hire one of the three guys that I just talked about. Did you watch the end of Mississippi State Auburn?
I did. Yep, I did.
What did you think of the timeout usages to ice the kickers?
I don't know. I'm not a big fan of that. You know, have I ever told you my other theory on that? Not that it would have applied necessarily at the end of the game. I hate that. So I think that if the defense uses a timeout to ice the kicker, that's fine. But the penalty is that if the kicker makes the kick, it's worth 4 points. If you use two, it's worth 5 points. And if you use all three to ice the kicker, then maybe you're just declared the automatic winner if the kicker makes the kick. So, you know, regardless of what it makes the score, even if it was just supposed to tie it. So I don't always love that.
I just thought they had like 30 something seconds left. Right. And like, we, you know, look at what Tennessee did. Again, Auburn's offense isn't exactly Tennessee's offense this year. Yeah. So I want to be very clear about that, but you with 30 seconds and all you need to do is get into field goal range. Like, I don't know. It's worth running a couple plays, run like a little, you know, sweep to Tank Bigsby and see if he breaks one. And I don't know.
Loose. Yeah.
Yeah. Like, no, I don't know. I was just, and again, there was an energy bolt there. He was in the moment. There was, you know, Brian Harsin, who's a very good coach, is not exactly an energy bolt. Mm-hmm. That's just not it. So you could tell the team fed off it. I give him a lot of credit for the, you know, the heart they showed in the comeback. But I did get a little like game management squeamish there at the end. I'm probably nitpicking, but I was just, I'm watching like, and the announcers, you know, to be fair, I think it was Tom Hart and Jordan Rogers and Cole Kubla could do a great job on our SEC Saturday night. I think they were all over it. I was just like, I don't know if I'd do that here.
Yeah. After the comeback they had, and you know, he's spinning the wheel of fortune, I think, at this point, you know, and the other thing too, I don't believe there's a scenario under which he gets a job, not because he's not a good coach. He just hasn't been coaching that long. Yeah. And that, you know, I mean, just, you know,
it's
maybe
a little like Dion, like all the, you know, the cries for Dion and just like, he's been a coach for 3 years.
Yeah. But that's true. But at least Dion's been the head coach, you know, for that period of time. I think that's a little bit different now, 5 years down the road. I mean, because Cadillac's profile just got elevated, maybe 3 years down the road. Yeah. So, you know, what does this mean for his career, whether it's at Auburn or somewhere else, depending on how they finish the rest of the way? But there, you mark my words, if they do that, if they win in Tuscaloosa, John Cohen will be under immense pressure, not from the proverbial powers that be at Auburn, but from the fans. They're going to want him because he is a beloved dude, and rightfully so, in Auburn history. So
Let me ask you this about that game, because this is in the back of my mind. The Mississippi State like messed up squib kick. You ever seen anything like that?
No, where I haven't.
There was no way that was intentional. Even Mike Leach's evilest genius could not have thought. I was like, I was on the flight home and I was like aghast. I was like, what?
Yeah. Yeah, that was just a turn of serendipity. That was not planned at all.
Yeah,
so,
no, it was pretty hilarious. Yeah. That game was big. And again,
that was wild.
Obviously LSU Alabama was great. One of the games of the season. It was awesome. The drama was intense, but it was not nearly as bananas as the end of Auburn Mississippi State, which was just bananas.
Yeah, it was perfect for that game to play out that way. First of all, because You got Leach. I mean, the two head coaches were Mike Leach and Cadillac Williams making his debut. You had the John Cohen thing. One AD left for the other school and didn't go to the game and watch from the new condo or whatever. You had chairs being folded up, fish sandwiches being discussed. I mean, and you know, squib kicks being recovered. You know, just it was bananas for sure. And we'll have more of that coming up, I'm sure, this week. I don't know if we, hopefully we've gleaned some insight here so that it can help us on our picks on the Friday podcast, because all of us were under 500 again last week, like, just by game. But yeah, we're burning it up.
I always feel good. Like, I was like, oh, I picked Notre Dame. Like, and then it's like, sad trombones. I picked Tennessee. I picked a lot of others that didn't work. So
that's the way it goes. What's before we go here, what's the best piece of news you've broken this week? Biggest and best piece of news.
I haven't broken it. I mean, Daquan Finn played for Toledo last night. I broke that. I've been a little under the weather, so I probably haven't been, grinding anything out like I normally have.
Well, one thing I've learned from working with you this year, if there's news to be broken, you're going to do it. So, I mean, it's, if anything of note has happened, the authority's going to have it. Every time, you hope.
You know, there's certainly no guarantees in the news breaking business, but it has been a little bit of a quiet week. Jeff Scott got fired on Sunday.
Yeah,
I did not break that story. Be clear about that. I think the school did. But we are about to enter a pretty busy time, and I feel like on our Sunday podcast, there's going to be a few more openings to discuss.
We're going to need to get you 100% and healthy, all that too. You know, they sent me the producers, Taylor and Sarah, sent me the rundown. On Monday, I think we might have discussed the Scott Frost T-shirt, but I'm not sure that we quite gave the love to Minnesota that we should have from last week for coming back and winning the $5 Bits of Broken Chair trophy, which is my favorite unofficial trophy in all of college football. So hats off to the Gophers.
Here's some good breaking news. I was told that in the Fleck household in suburban Minneapolis, all three Christmas trees have already been erected. So there you go. Yeah,
PJ's and big decorated? Christmas guy. Yeah,
yeah.
Good King Wenzel class. I'm gonna bungle the song. That's his go-to Christmas jam. So, they are already counting the days of Christmas down there in old Minnesota. So,
well, you got a Christmas cup in your coffee, and you were somewhat chagrined by this.
I just thought it was a little early. So my birthday's in mid-November, and I feel like that's the breakoff point. I don't want anything. I'm not naive enough to think it's going to last till Thanksgiving. Right. But I just feel like now the weather has kind of turned here a little bit. It was like 70 on Monday and it's kind of cold now. I'm just not ready for a green cup of coffee at Dunkin' Donuts yet. Like the actual cup being green. I just felt the pinch early. That's all. Are you ready for the holiday season, Reese?
I'm not Pollock-esque.
Pollock, like a big elf.
Oh yeah, Pollock loves Christmas music. He would like to play it, in mid-October. He doesn't like Thanksgiving because of the food component of it, which is, he doesn't like to, a holiday that is centered around gorging yourself. So he's not into that. So he wants to just skip ahead to Christmas. I love Thanksgiving too, though. But I'm okay if you play a little Christmas music leading up to Thanksgiving. I'm okay with that.
What's your date cutoff? When do you feel good about it?
I would say probably after Halloween, but only it's not because I get annoyed by it. I don't want to be tired of it by the time you're leading up to it, and the few days before Christmas. So just a little patience can help.
I feel like every holiday should have their box. Like Halloween gets its box, Thanksgiving gets its box, Christmas gets its box, and everybody's good. But
you just slipped in though. Your birthday's coming up. When is your birthday?
Oh, it's November 16th.
Oh, November 16th. So a week. So we're going to do a podcast on your birthday?
I think we may do
a podcast. Would you like Taylor and Sarah to sing to you?
Not particularly. I'm not one of these, like, my birthday is like a four-day celebration guys, but you may find that hard to believe. So if you just said happy birthday to me, I'd say thanks. And that'd be nice.
Okay. All right. Put that on our calendar to remind us to all say happy birthday to Pete.
Yeah. If I could get a birthday present and be able to breathe out of my sinuses, I'd be a pretty happy guy. So
what you need is a new neti pot.
Oh, the neti pot's been going, man. The neti pot's been going. I'm a big neti pot guy.
I've never done that. I'm I'm afraid to, and look, I have some of those issues a little more frequently than I would like, but I'm afraid that somehow the brain eating amoeba is going to go up my sinuses and get there through the neti pot. That seems like an altogether
like a bottle of water. We have distilled water for Teddy's formula. Yeah. So I actually don't use like tap water for it.
Yeah, no, you can't. You're not supposed to, right?
No, you're not supposed to.
But that seems completely
I have in the past gotten yelled at. But no, yeah, if you warm up the water a little bit and put a little salt in, just shoots right through the sinuses. It's bliss.
It seems unpleasant.
It's when you get very used to it, it's awkward, right? Because you're like, I'm putting water up a nostril, it's coming out another. It's just unnatural. Mm-hmm. But you get used to it. But like, there is very linear, like, you know, you can take all these medicines and all these, you know, cough drops and all that stuff. But like, there's just few like, oh, this is what it's doing. I'm actually watching it clear my sinuses. And there's something satisfying about that.
Probably like, find a little satisfaction in that. And hopefully we can find some satisfaction with the picks on the Friday podcast. Partner, I'm glad you're feeling better. Get you 100% by the time we go to Austin this weekend. And certainly by the time we unveil the Friday podcast full of picks with the great Bill Connolly, who will join us then. Thanks for listening to this ESPN College Game Day podcast. We ask you to download this wherever it is that you like to get your podcast.